very narrow lines. I think it was green, blue, and yellow lines making up the bluish-white color. So definitely do not have to have. You can have your single, discrete colors adding together to make a composite.
Yes, exactly, and that's how it's certainly done for white. There is no frequency of a photon that's the color, in quotation marks, white. It's a combination. Our retina has the ability to perceive three ranges of color, and judging by the lack of one, or the absence of one, or the presence of one or two, and the amplitude, it goes into your brain, and you come up and you give people a color. But it could be multiple different frequency photons hitting your eyes, and you say, oh, that's brown. As opposed to in prisms and in rainbows, which work on refraction as well, in which it breaks up the different spectrums to discrete energy packets, that each of those photons has a specific frequency, and they don't mix in prisms or rainbows.
KG2R1.
Yes, David.
If green and orange are in the prism, green and orange, when you mix them together, gives you a lighter shade of brown.
Okay, like I said, brown is a composite perceived color. So it's a combination of more than one frequency of light.
Right. When you add them together, it's like red, green, and blue. It's like, you know, what you can get from red, green, and blue.
Yeah, and along the way, I should mention to people out there, if they're forgetting, there's kind of two different ways of thinking about color. What we're talking about, for the most part, is additive color that is seen from any kind of object that projects color. On the flip side, when you're playing with crayons and such, you're not talking about additive colors, you're talking about subtractive colors. So the colors subtract differently, obviously, than they add.
KD2WOT.
Yes, Chris.
I would just say, always remember Roy G. Biv. That is red, orange, yellow, blue, indigo, violet.
Yes, that's what I just did 10 minutes ago, because I forgot exactly how it worked. And it's kind of easy for me to remember that, since it starts with Roy.
Yep, Roy G. Biv. That's the colors of the rainbow.
Yes, indeed. Okay, very good. Any other comments on this subject? Feel free.
I remember a cute acronym for remember resistor color code. But I learned something tonight. I never thought of color as being a combination of several individual wavelengths. I thought, for example, like when David said that two colors mixed to make brown, I thought brown existed in the rainbow in between those two colors. But apparently not. Brown can consist of three colors or four, or something else could consist of three or four, so there's no in-between, and the only way you can get that perceived color is to mix the primary colors of it.
Yeah, I'll give you another example, another color that we see all the time that is not based on a single frequency, the color pink.
I have a silly question.
I'm sure it's not silly, Ed.
It's been a long time, so let me bounce the background. Let me make sure I have this right off. Brown alpha lines. There are two very narrow spectral lines in yellow spectrum that are absorbed by hydrogen, I believe. And daylight hitting the Earth is missing those two colors. that correct?
Yes, that's correct, but it's very difficult to perceive that unless you have some very nice equipment.
So I assume that those missing colors do not distort the net effect of the daylight versus the ideal.
I have never seen anyone suggest. Also, you have to keep in mind that this is absorptive spectroscopy. The sun doesn't operate through spectroscopy. It basically is the black body radiation. So I would think that there is some degree of that frequency passing, just a lot less than the rest of the spectrum.
Yeah. All right, now let me take this completely down the rabbit hole. Today for Mother's Day, we were at a family gathering with a young child, and the subject of favorite colors came up. And I thought of that with the Fraunhofer line, that my favorite color is those Fraunhofer line yellows, because they don't really exist.
Okay, that's sort of getting into, what's the sound of one hand clapping. That's the absorption line, I think, for mercury.
I don't remember what the absorption line for, but I just thought it. I just dare say it.
Yeah, some jokes are a wee bit too clever for the crowd.
KT2R1.
Yes, David?
If you wanted to make a color pink on your paint palette, you're making a painting, and you want to make the color pink, you would take white and red, mix it together in different degrees.
Well, yes, but white itself is not a single color. So what you're really doing is you're taking, say, red, green, and blue, and that's making white, and then you're adding more red to it. So again, it's a complex color that's not really triggering for a given frequency, but for a combination of different frequencies.
Well, if you're making a painting, the result is reflected. So like with acrylics and oil paint, white is considered a color. Maybe it has different gradation, shade, little bit of a tint to it, and then you can mix that with the paint. How does it look when it's done, and then you put the varnish on top of that?
Yeah, but effectively what's going on in your retina is you're seeing the red, and the white that you're adding to the red paint is being perceived as triggering your red detector, your blue detector, and your green detector. And so all three of them are firing. The most signal is on the red detector. When it goes up into your brain, it says, pink. It doesn't start to deconstruct the different photon reflections in the paint. But that's what I was getting at. There are simple colors that are derived from simple monochromatic given frequency or wavelength photons, and then there are colors like brown and pink that are complex, made up of more than one energy photon. Brown can be made up of two photons. Pink requires pretty much, I think, three photons in order to give you that pink color. So that was just a nuance I was trying to spread about.
Don't you realize that the pink and the brown, whatever you create, the paint, you mix the paint on and then you put it on the canvas, and it dries, you put some varnish on it. It really also depends what color the light is, how light or dark the room is, and stuff like that.
And your KW?
Yes, Alan.
Yeah, David, what you have to keep in mind when you look at a painting is you're looking at the color that the paint has reflected, not the color that painting is illuminated with. For example, if the painting were to be illuminated with one color, you would see that color paint reflected, but the other colors would appear dark or dull or non-existent altogether. It's very much dependent upon the light, over.
I agree with you, Alan, and I'm sorry, but I forgot to use the word reflective.
Yeah, well, when we look at a light source, we're looking at the color of light, or we're looking at what our eye responds to in that electromagnetic radiation. But when you look at a painting, you're only looking at what the painting reflects, not what the painting absorbs.
Yeah, QSL, it's all about the reflection.
Okay, very good. Yeah, like I mentioned a couple of weeks ago when I was doing something on flat screens, display screens, which is a kind of an electronic version, they come in kind of three different flavors. There are reflective. E-paper is an example of reflective displays. They reflect originally just black and white, but now they're going to be doing it in color, which is interesting. Then you have transmissive, which is liquid crystal displays. They let filtered light through polarizing material. And then you have organic light emitting diodes, which are emissive devices. They actually emit photons of a given color. In the case of the most new technology, they use blue organic light emitting diodes and small little quantum dots that can absorb the blue light and reflect back red or green, depending upon which subpixel.
WS2AD has a new question on this subject.
And WS2N.
Okay, head first, then Paul.
I think you're going to like this one, Roy. It's very simple but elegant. Back in the day, when I was in junior high school, there were three primary colors, red, blue, and yellow. And by looking at a spectrum, it made a lot of sense. For example, you mix yellow and the blue, you make green. And you mix the red and yellow, you make orange. So it's kind of like blue is at one end, red is at the other, and yellow is the point in the middle. Then all of a sudden, with color TV, it was red, blue, and green. And my question is, what happened? And I cannot for the life of me envision how you would make yellow with a palette of red, blue, and green. I just can't see it.
Okay, we touched upon that earlier. There's two types of palettes to think of. When you were working with crayons back in the old days, you were talking about subtractive colors. When you subtract one color from another and you get the crayon color. So that's subtractive. That happens in paints. It happens in printing. It happens with crayons. Display devices use additive colors, where you're adding colors to the mix. So, you know, when you're mixing red, green, and blue, adding it together in a emissive display, it looks white to you. If you bring your pupil really close to the screen, you can make out the individual colored grids, but from a distance, it all merges together and your retina is white. So it's the difference between additive color spectrum and subtractive color spectrum.
Wonderful, but I don't see how it doesn't. I hear you, but I'm not seeing any difference. But I don't know if I want to hold everything else.
And 2KW?
Okay, Alan recognized, you know, I just want to put my 2 cents worth in. If you take a blue crayon, blue crayon is not completely perfectly blue. It's very blue with a bit of color on either end of the spectrum. And then you take a yellow crayon, which is very yellow with color off to the side, and you mix them together. The blue kind of blocks the yellow blocks the blue, and you're sort of left with the stuff on the side, which looks very green. But, Alan, you have something to say.
Okay. I got to think about that. I never heard the term additive and subtractive before, but it's certainly apt. And maybe another way to visualize the same concept is to say that when you're looking at paint or crayons or anything that's reflecting light, it's a filter. And you're seeing only what it reflects. It's filtering the light that it receives, and you're only seeing what it reflects. And I think that's what he meant by subtractive. Over.
What's that, Chief? Yeah, something better to do someday. Just Google the term subtractive color, and you'll see how red, green, and blue kind of merge together and give you black instead of white. You could sort of do the same thing by Googling additive color, where things add up and turn to white.
Okay, I shall. That's two things that I learned tonight.
Oh, that's very good. I try for at least one new thing, so it's good that you got two.
Yeah, any day you can learn something is a good day.
I agree with you 100%. Any other comments on this subject before we call it a night and move on to the SpaceNet report?
AWS2N.
Oh, yeah, I'm terribly sorry, Paul. I forgot that you were next in line to say something. Yes, please, Paul.
I just wanted to say that somebody was looking to ask an antenna question on the chat room. They were waiting for this topic to be finished. I'm not sure if you can make it into the repeater or not. KC2NKL. Not hearing anything. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, I think N2ZC was trying to say something via Echo Link, so let's keep our fingers off the push-to-talk button, give him a chance again.
Yeah, thank you, Roy. No, I'm just having some trouble with the Echo Link here, so sorry for that interruption.
Okay, no problem. Yes, apparently the Echo Link times out and loses its audio at times, unfortunately. Hopefully someone will figure out exactly what's causing that and stop it from doing it. I'm looking through the chat room. I don't really see the question. Do you remember where it was in the chat room? Was it at the bottom? Was it at the top? Was it in the middle?
At the bottom. KC2NKL. At the very bottom. Well, it's moved up a little bit. Yeah, near the bottom.
Okay, yeah, I found it. It's not actually a question. It says, when the color discussion is done, I wouldn't mind asking an antenna question. So, KC2NKL, if you can get on the radio or Echo Link, or if you could just type it into your chat room, I'll see what we can do.
November 2, Zulu Charlie.
Yes, John?
Yeah, if he doesn't get back to you, if he does, just go right ahead with him. If not, listening to your earlier conversation then, would it be correct, let's say we took the typical, what we see, the ground plane antenna that we use in CB, which I believe that's a quarter wave antenna and it has three ground radios, then is the purpose of those three ground radios just to give a better impedance match? Is that, would that be a logical conclusion of the purpose of them?
2KW.
Yes, Alan. Put you on the list. I just want to add my 2 cents, and then you could add your 3 cents. And, John, it does affect the impedance, but it also affects the general physics. With a quarter-wave monopole, you sort of have a seesaw where half of your saw is sawed off. So it doesn't really work very well. You need to have an element balancing it in order for it to work. So you use some kind of a counterpoise. Theoretically, you could just take another piece of wire that's a quarter of a wavelength and have it someplace connected to the other part of the transmission line, but effectively that will give you a distorted radiation pattern. So you instead put three radials at equidistance away from each of them so that you have a nice a 360-degree radiation pattern. So that's why you have three elements. It's a counterpoise to offer the laws of physics a somewhat balanced solution to the exchange of currents back and forth and getting the antenna to radiate properly. But, Alan, what do you want to say?
Well, I first of all, I agree with you that quarter wave needs a mirror image to work against. The antenna is a half wave. Of course, you could have a simple dipole oriented vertically, or you could run your coax up the center of the pipe, and then you'd have a so-called coaxial antenna, which is nothing more than a vertical dipole. The original vertical had one or two radials. Somebody said nobody buy it like that, so they came out with three and four. And of course, the more radials, the more efficient it is, but really the basic antenna is just a vertical dipole, and the three radials are simply a mirror image that quarter wave is working against. Over.
Yes, Ed recognized. Once again, want to throw in my two cents. I don't think it's just for beauty purposes. The reason why a lot of people settle on three radials in order to get kind of symmetry, they want an antenna that's not lopsided. If you stick a quarter wave onto a car and use the body of the car as a radial, you'll have it be somewhat directional depending upon where it's located on the body of the car. If you put it on the rear bumper, say, where most of the radial metal is in front of it, you will get a radiation pattern that kind of favors the front view. So that's the reason why you want three radials, so that you get some kind of balanced, uniform pattern. The reason why you would like to have a lot of radials at some times is when it's mounted very close to the ground, and you also want to shield it from ground coupling and losing a lot of the RF into the ground and just warming up the soil, and as Dick used to say, warming up the worms. So that's my little two cents. Ed, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, my take is as follows. In theory, in the basic theory, a vertical antenna is a quarter wave speaking of vertical, and the base is an infinitely large in all directions, perfectly conducting ground plane. Now that's a theoretical idea, which would be all immediately recognized as absurdly impractical. But let's go one step further. A vertical antenna tends to throw the energy at a radiation angle that's pretty much optimized for HF skip on 20 meters. But for VHF and the like, with your line of sight, you really want to focus it more towards the horizon. So this ideal would become you're at the top of a very gentle cone, so that the moves down the point of radiation, it does change the impedance also. Then you get down to, well, how can we simulate that? And what turns out is radials 120 degrees apart is the simplest and cheapest approximation that is an embarrassment.
Okay, but I think the point is it's for symmetry's sake. People use counterpoises all the time, which effectively is going to distort the radiation pattern of the vertical. It'll go off towards where the counterpoise tends to be directed. So you want something that's symmetrical, so that you'll get a relatively even distribution across 360 degrees. So they won't be favoring the front of the antenna or the back or the sides or such.
K2FIU.
George, recognize. Hang on. I agree, but the point I'm saying is with one or two radios doing a distorted pattern that favors some direction, one reasonable radiation in all directions, the more radios the better. But usually, for most purposes, three just gives you a little bit of variation that really in the end is going to get lost in the source.
Okay, I pretty much agree. I think that you really get diminishing returns. As long as you have the vertical high enough that you do not have to shield it from ground coupling losses, you don't really, you know, to go from 3 to 4, maybe you'll make it a little bit uniform, but you certainly don't have to go to the 36 radials that a ground-mounted vertical often will have, because it has to shield from coupling to ground and have ground loss problems.
I think 36 radials is the ego, period.
Okay, I mean, I have read a lot of different articles. They did some articles on the ARRL's high-tech type of thing, where the guy did all kinds of measurements with different number of radials and different lengths of radials. And I don't know. I think if you're shielding from ground loss, 36 isn't a completely insane thing. If you've elevated your antenna above where it's going to couple to the ground and you're doing 36 radials, then you're a little bit strange, in my humble opinion.
And 2KW.
KD2FIU.
Okay, George first and then Alan.
Looking at the ground plane itself, you have what is the dipole that is out and up. And if you use one element, you're going to have the somewhat of a direction of that dipole with that out, horizontal. Out and up was a concept that was utilized basically after World War II by people working 40 meters in California who were trying to make friends with their new friends in Japan. And they would take their 40-meter dipoles and swing one leg up into trees. Now we have the dipole antenna vertically half swung. Why did we go to three elements? Let me come back. We also were learning at that point that an inverted V antenna was fully optimized at 120 degrees as fully directional. Now you have a horizontal plane with the 120 degree elements, and you have one plane at dipole vertical. You're capturing a tremendous amount of area. KD2FIU.
Okay, thank you, George. Alan, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, the application for a ground plane is very different for HF and for VHF stroke UHF. At VHF and UHF, all that matters is height. As a matter of fact, if you want to make it over a mountain, you're better off with horizontal polarization, because then you get knife edge refraction, which you don't get when you're vertically polarized. But all the mobiles are vertically polarized. Repeaters are all vertically polarized. All that really matters is height. Let me let it drop. And you're absolutely correct. When you're operating mobile and you have the antenna mounted at the back of the car, it favors the front, because it favors where the ground plane is. But that's not necessarily bad. For example, I'm a contester, and on low-frequency bands, it's impossible to get an antenna, horizontal antenna, up a half wavelength. Everybody uses vertical polarization on the low-frequency bands, or quickly learns to. And from the East Coast, winning a contest is all about work in Europe. So I don't really care about my signal to the west or to the south. But if I don't have a signal to the south, that's my Lopez filter over.
Okay, I understand that entirely, Alan. I just think that on a commercial designed antenna, a lot of designers want to remove the variable of what direction your car is going, whether your signal fades or boosts. And like I said before, a lot of people just use a counterpoise, and they use the counterpoise intelligently to guide the radiation pattern in the direction that they want.
Yeah, well, in the case of a car, a lot of truckers use two-phase vertical so that their pattern is front and rear, because that's who they're interested in talking to, over.
Okay, yeah, I mean, special cases require special solutions. I think the average guy in his mobile, in his car, just wants a general, all-round, non-directional antenna, and so the commercial manufacturers tend to stick those three little short, stubby radials, and most people tend to be happy.
Yeah, well, that's why I went with NMO, because I wanted it in the center of the roof for a change.
Okay, that's a reasonable decision.
KD2FIU.
Yes, George, I want to wrap this up soon because I'm really feeling bad about taking time away from Paul.
Oh, sorry. Oh, gosh. the CLR-2, designed by High Gain. Probably early mid-1960s. And the concept was to not use four horizontal radials for the tuned antenna. Use three, because you have the 120-degree angle capture on horizontal in each direction, and then you have your vertical. And that's what I was trying to get at. KD2FIU, over to you, Roy.
Okay, very good, George. I hope everyone enjoyed themselves. I had a lot of fun. I learned some things. Alan learned some things. I'm sure a lot of other people listening, participating, learned some things. So another great first segment of the TechNet. And for the second segment of the TechNet, I'm sorry, Paul, that we delayed your segment, WS2N with the SpaceNet report.
Oh, no problem, Roy. You know, this is a TechNet. I'm more interested in the antenna topics. I'm learning something instead of me talking about the space program. Not a problem. Plus, we always have additional time now. You know, this net used to go on a regular basis all the way till 12 o'clock, and then the repeat used to quit and at that time. But now, you know, we generally go to 11, sometimes now a little after. But the repeater was still open until 12 for general use. Anyway, there's a couple of launches coming up in May and June and August, the next couple of months. This one in May, the second test flight by Firefly. And another private company. A few months ago, they almost made it to orbit. Not many companies even get off the launch pad when they launch, you know, with their first attempt. And they did. It's not a huge rocket. It's about 100 feet tall. They could probably get around 2,000-pound payload into orbit if they make it. It's a 6-foot diameter rocket there. And they run four kerosene-type engines. They call it RP-1. And liquid oxygen engines, and they name their engines Reaver, four Reaver engines. So it's a little Lib is almost 200,000 pounds of thrust. So it's a pretty large rocket. And they made it off the launch pad like, I don't know, 4 or 5 months ago. And they got to the first stage, but then there was a glitch. They said one of the wires apparently came loose on one of the rockets. They didn't have enough power to get to orbit, so they detonated it. They have a flight termination system that they do manually, and now sometimes we think that automatic. If they go way off course, they'll detonate themselves on a flight termination system. But now they're going to do it again this May, probably toward the end of the month. And they launch out of, right now they're launching out of California, Vandenberg Air Force Base. And usually every, they launch due south, from polar orbits from that location. But for the test, they're just launching due west. They don't want to hit anything. They're just going due west. Just in case something went wrong, they're going to try to make it to orbit. And if they do, they plan on, like, once a month, right off in the beginning, launching, one rocket after the other, and eventually from the East Coast as well, from Florida. So that would be another private company. We have a lot of people trying to do this, and some have been successful, but I think these people are going to make it. Firefly. They call it the Alpha rocket. They have a future plan for a larger rocket called Beta, which is essentially taking three of the same rockets, bubbling them together, getting more power that way. They also have a lunar lander planned. They're working with Israel to duplicate what they tried to do a few years back. Israel tried to land their spacecraft on the moon, and they wound up crashing into the moon at the last couple of seconds. And this company is now working with Israel to try to duplicate that, except with naturally a more modern, better lander that they're designing. So we'll see how Firefly does. Another launch coming up this May. One second. August. Very beginning of August is the Psyche mission. Psyche is a spacecraft that's being developed that will go to an asteroid, also called Psyche. Big metal asteroid, about 140 miles. It's like the length of, a little longer than the length of Long Island, but naturally a sphere. A big iron chunk of metal in the asteroid belt that they would love to investigate. They've never gone to an asteroid similar to that. So they developed the spacecraft, and it's a large one. I mean, it's a good sized spacecraft itself, but the solar panels on it, they need around 5 kilowatt of power to run this thing. The panels are as big as a tennis court, and they have a all ion thrusters on board, which will they'll be able to relatively get out to the asteroid belt quickly. Probably make it there by the very beginning of 2026. So, a couple of years from now, they'll actually go into orbit. With the ion thrusters, they're able to slow down enough to actually go into orbit around this thing, and eventually the orbit will get smaller and smaller each time it gets closer to the asteroid. They'll get better pictures, and they have instruments on board, spectrometers and things, to analyze this thing. So that's going to be one of the dramatic liftoffs by SpaceX. They haven't done it for a while, and they have two this year. One actually supposed to occur earlier than August for the military. And that's one of the SpaceX heavy, Falcon Heavy launches. Falcon Heavy normally consists of, one large booster. Around, the rocket is usually around 250 feet tall, and it was a booster. they've been bringing them back either on a drone ship or they come back to land. And they've got about 100 of these. But they return them safely and they've relaunched them. And this is one of these dramatic ones that you probably saw it before a few years ago. They haven't done one in a while where the Falcon Heavy goes up and the two side boosters, one on the port, one on the starboard side, come, you know, separate after about 2 minutes in flight. They do a 180 and relight the engine, start doing flyback. And those two are, you know, 200, I guess those boosters are about 230 feet tall, come back and land in Florida. They have a landing pad there at used to be called Launch Complex 13 years ago, but they've done away with the Launch Complex. They turned it over to SpaceX, and he's got two concrete pads there. And these two boosters will come down simultaneously. Four legs will open up, and they land on it in California, you know, maybe a couple miles from where they took off. The Santa booster, it doesn't look like they're going to try to save that one. I read that one will be expendable. They tried it twice before with this type of configuration. They have a drone ship that goes out there, and they have it, you know, one of them hit, fell over. Another one wasn't able to make it to the drone ship at all. And I don't think he thinks it's worth it. You have to send this booster maybe, you know, 600 or 700 miles out to sea instead of the normal 300 or 400 miles out to sea to try to catch this thing. So I think they're just going to, you know, be done with that and let that go into the sea. But, you know, we'll see if Psyche makes it. We'll be looking forward to eventually seeing the results of orbiting a small asteroid like that. Naturally, it's past Mars, in between Mars and Jupiter, where the asteroid belt is. Any questions or comments? WS2X. Okay. Just want to cover the Electron rocket. Yeah. Rocket is made by Rocket Lab. Rocket Lab launches presently out of New Zealand, out of the North Island of New Zealand. He's got a launch complex that he built there. And recently he's built a second launch complex on that island as well, you know, very close to the first one. So he'll be able to increase his launches. He's got plenty of launches on his manifest where he has that demand. And these rockets are, you know, smaller than, actually, a lot smaller than the Falcon 9. They're even smaller than the Alpha rocket that I mentioned before by Firefly. But, I mean, he's been setting them up. I think he's got 22, 23 successful launches. He's also built a launch complex in Virginia at Wallops Island that he hasn't used yet. Still waiting for the okay from our government. But that's actually been complete for almost 2 years now. And, you know, once he gets the paperwork ready to go on the automatic light detonation system for that rocket, then he'll be able to start launching from Virginia. He expects to do that sometime this year, of course. But I've heard that every year for the last couple of years. But anyway, he's got the Electron booster that last week he tried to catch the booster in midair with a helicopter. Except it's a Sikorsky helicopter, S-92, large helicopter, and the pilot flies. And, you know, he goes out around the ocean. I think he takes off from their boat. And right after launch, the first stage separates from second stage. Second stage pushes, in this case, there were 32 satellites into orbit, and that was successful. Their goal is to recover the booster and then eventually reuse that. They haven't done it yet. The idea is to not have the booster touch the salt water. So they don't plan on landing on a barge like SpaceX does, but they plan on catching it with this helicopter. So the helicopter saw the booster coming down after about 2.5 minutes of flight, stage separation, and eventually this thing starts coming down with a parachute. Decelerates with quite a bit. And it looks different than the regular boosters. It's all carbon coated. This thing's got some kind of aluminum frame or something on it. I don't think it's stainless, but it's all shiny. It's hard to find out. It's got some kind of a coating on it, some kind of protective shield for heat. Parachute opens up, and then it's a drogue parachute, and another parachute opens up. The drogue parachute stays attached, so it's basically a long horizontal, cable between two parachutes as it's coming down. Helicopter comes in, grabs it with a hook, and they actually succeeded in grabbing it. Started to slow the booster down, like 6,000 feet up in the air. Which I thought was pretty high for a helicopter, but I guess not. But he's grabbed the load, and then they said the pilot felt the load wasn't right. Must have been pulling them all over the place, or maybe there's too much fuel left in the booster. I'm not sure yet. But anyway, he was uncomfortable with it, so he pushed a button and released it. After a few seconds of hanging onto it. But, first time they successfully grabbed a booster flying out of coming down out of space. And it wasn't space, it was, 60 miles high. So, had to slow down from like 4,000 mile an hour speed down to 26 miles an hour when the helicopter grabbed it. So maybe next time I'll be able to do it, or a time after that. We'll see. If he had grabbed it, the plan was to fly it back to land. They also have future plans of catching the booster and landing, and then bringing the booster and having the booster land on a ship out at sea, and bringing it back that way. And then once they could bring it back, they could relaunch the. It's got nine engines. Nine Rutherford engines, each one not producing that much thrust. I think it's only 6,000 pounds of thrust, something like that, with each engine. I think for a total of 50,000 pounds of thrust, which isn't much. You take the engines on a 747, and each one of those is over 50,000 pounds of thrust. So this whole thing collectively is only 50,000 pounds of thrust. So how does it make it to space? Naturally it's bringing all its own fuel and liquid oxygen. So, I guess if you took a Rolls Royce engine off of an airplane and, pointed it straight up and had enough fuel and liquid oxygen to it, I guess that engine would eventually make it to space. Kept it going long enough, straight up, and then horizontal, so it could go into orbit. Anyway, that's what the Electron does. It runs on electric motors, all electric motors. It runs on lithium-ion batteries. In fact, when they get high up, they have television pictures of this thing going to orbit. Not only do they show the separation of the second stage and first stage, they'll actually get it, and also the fairings that cover the satellites, see them separate. But, they know that the lithium-ion batteries that they use are running down, so they leave the booster. They fly away, and then new batteries take over. New lithium ion, so that brings the vehicle to orbit. Pretty good idea. Most engines are run with the turbo systems where you have the exhaust or pre-burners of the fuel and liquid oxygen, actually creating its own thrust, which pushes the turbines, which pushes the pumps, which in turn push all the fuel into, liquid oxygen and liquid fuel into the combustion chambers. So they've made a big change. A couple of other companies are doing that as well. Astra is now doing it. Their rocket, which they plan on launching a few of those rockets in the next couple of months too. So things are moving along. It's not only NASA, not only the foreign countries with their space programs, a lot of commercial companies here in the United States. The spacecraft called Capstone that is actually being built in Colorado, and it's due to fly again at the end of May. Capstone is a small spacecraft. It's got a bunch of small spacecraft stuck together. Each spacecraft is a CubeSat. So, if you see a story about a CubeSat, now they say it's a 3U unit. That means it's three CubeSats, kind of like bolted together. 6U unit would be 6. Well, this one's 12, so it's got 12 cubes. Each cube is, the initial designs are 10 centimeters square cube.
That
so
time, complete.
Probably 4-inch cubes, 12 of them put together, and that makes up the spacecraft called the Capstone. And they give it a name called Capstone, but it's really a stand for the big long thing when I have a pro down here. Cislunar Autonomous Positioning System Technology Operations and Navigation Experiment. Anyway, Capstone is heading to the moon. It's going to be launched by this company that launches the Electron rocket, I just told you about with ones that's trying to catch with a helicopter, to try to catch the first stage. That company, Rocket Lab, run by another, I guess he's almost a billionaire now, Peter Beck, because he's doing quite well with his rocket system. That company is launching this for the United States. It's going to, again, launch from New Zealand, and it's going to head to the moon. And the reason for that is they want to put it into a halo orbit. This halo orbit is very elongated orbit, let's put it that way. They call it the near rectilinear orbit, which means that the orbit is so elongated that if you were to look at the sides, going up and going down, if you trace that orbit, it would look like they're almost like linear to one another, or side by side, or parallel. It's that sharp of an orbit, so no way near oval, but it will be in orbit around the moon. Yeah, high point of, I think it was 47,000 miles. That's how hot the high point of the moon. And then the low point is around 2,000 miles. So if you were to look at it from Earth, it would be doing a polar orbit around the moon, and it would have this multi-day orbit. I mean, it would take, you know, like a week for it to make one orbit. And what it does is, around it, when it goes down by the South Pole, that's when it's like 47,000 miles away. So for all those days, let's call it, you know, in a week, if you had a crew on the moon, the South Pole, you'd be able to talk to this capstone satellite, theoretically, for that whole week. And then it'll take like a day, or less than a day, for it to go around the North Pole of the moon. So the idea is to eventually, you know, we want to set up a base up near the South Pole of the moon. And so you want, you know, constant communications, high data. Eventually we'll be going, you know, to the satellites that will be going around in this particular orbit. So naturally, with this, they want to experiment. They want to make sure that they communicate properly, and they're going to use a satellite that's already in orbit around the moon called Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. That's been going around in orbit since 2009, so all these years. But this capstone will be able to communicate with that and then also transmit back to Earth. And if all goes well and the orbit is stable, they have big plans for this halo orbit. Eventually they plan on putting a space station out there called Gateway. Gateway will eventually carry astronauts and hopefully future ham radio astronauts as well, like we have in low Earth orbits nowadays. And that'll be a waypoint for our future missions to land on the moon. You would send the SLS, the Space Launch System, would launch Orion with a crew of four, for instance, fly all the way to the halo orbit. It would dock with the Gateway system, and up from there you would get into another transfer vehicle, separate from the Gateway, go down, land on the moon, whatever time your mission is there for. And eventually, it's time to leave, you would launch again and go back to the Gateway space station, which is going to be manned, by the way, on a regular basis. When the crews launch from Earth on Orion and they arrive at Gateway, there'll be a crew to meet them. There'll be, I think they plan on, 2 months stays in orbit, especially for crews, and then they'll leave, and maybe the station will be unoccupied for maybe a couple of months at a time too. That might happen as well. The space station will be completely autonomous. You won't need anybody there really to fly it. Oh, that's what they plan on doing. You come back up off the moon, dock with Gateway Station in its halo orbit, and off to back to Earth. And the present plans are still to splash down in the Pacific Ocean and get picked up by a ship. So, I don't know. Any questions, comments? Past 11 o'clock, but that's okay. We can take a question or two if anybody has one. Otherwise, this is WS2N, name your school. Nothing heard. We're going to turn it over to you, Roy. Thanks for the time. And we'll be here tomorrow night. Like I usually say, that Club InfoNet is on this frequency. If you're not a member, it doesn't matter. You can check in anyway. That's always followed by George, KD2FIU, with the Swap and Shop. And always after that, you have Newsline. Roy, over to you. And we'll be here next week or sometime during the week, hopefully. AC2GS, WS2N.
Okay, thank you very much, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report. Thank you for all that you do for the technical net. Thank you for all that you do for the club. Well, I hope everyone enjoyed themselves. I didn't get to the to the puzzle tonight again. I think that's the fourth or fifth time. Well, we'll get to it eventually. There's lots of information on it on my link page. So I just want to remind people, I want to thank everyone who participated.